Get started. Let's start with a word of prayer. Father, we do thank you for your love. We thank you for the beauty of your heart. We thank you for the quietness and the peace of your heart that you're willing to share with us. We thank you that you are not a spectacular kind of circus God, that you do all this weird stuff, but that you are quiet and that you're practical and that you meet us where we are in our needs and our daily life, that you broke in the history in quiet ways and beautiful ways, especially in the person of your Son, especially in the prophets that wrote these things down, the psalmists that experienced your grace and power in their lives and shared this for us under your inspiration. And we ask as we look at your study tonight, Lord, that you would bless our hearts with a knowledge of your presence, a sense of your involvement in our lives, an increasing sense of your involvement, that we could see you more in our lives and be aware of your comfort, be aware of your companionship in everything we do. And we ask that we would honor you more and delight in you more because of what we did tonight. Thank you for this and the forgiveness of sins. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, now in our studies, we are on Psalm 4. So we did, remember we started with Psalm 1, was about the tree planted by the waters. You draw from God and His resources and His strength, and the tree doesn't work real hard. And then we saw immediately in Psalm 2, we had international conflict, war against the tree. You know, and so we had to apply this being grounded in God. The psalmist had to deal with Moab, and you know, the enemies on the other side of the River Jordan is what we were talking about, that were fighting with David. So this was just normal, you know, troubles against him. Wasn't necessarily anything he had done. It was just, you know, people picking fights, basically. You know, enemies that just stirring up trouble because of who they were. And then we looked at at Psalm 3, and Psalm 3, of course, had a caption. It was about troubles in the family. We had Absalom. The problem with Absalom, we got somebody coming in right there.
Come on.
Welcome. Welcome. Hey, how you doing? Welcome, welcome.
I'm doing good.
Oh, wonderful.
Did y'all meet
that one? No.
Oh, good. I didn't miss. Well, he was out.
I was out of town. Do you have notes in your binder? Have you got notes in there? If you don't, I'll just give you a brand new fresh binder with all the additions.
Let's see. I don't think I marked on any of these.
Well, just keep it. I tell you, keep it. Just transfer it there. It's just a fresh copy that's got all the additional pages from a while back there. Okay. And we were just reviewing. We'd only got started about 5 minutes ago.
Okay. You didn't have any
new papers. No new papers this time. Right. We probably will. Maybe next time.
All right.
We're getting close to that. What we were talking about was that in Psalm 1, of course, was where we started with the tree planted by the waters. It set the framework for all of the Psalms, that the way you stay healthy and you grow and you weather and things of this type is you put your roots down into God, into His sources and His Word. He set the whole system up to where when you get dry, you go to the Word. You take a few minutes, you listen to Him in the Scripture. When you need strength, when you know you're fixing to be in trouble, you take a few minutes, you go read a couple Psalms, you go read a little of the Gospel, something, and say, Lord, I need, you know, the breakfast of champions. I need some strength there, basically. And so Psalm 1 was about just basically what the core of the spiritual life was about. Then Psalm 2 put us immediately in that international conflict. No sooner had we relaxed because we said, okay, trees are not supposed to work real hard, than all of a sudden we have enemies at the borders. We've got these foreigners, Moab and Ammon, on the other side of Jordan. They're trying to... We were doing fine. I mean, we were minding our own business in Israel, and, you know, David was doing trying to do a good job and boost the economy and help the families. All of a sudden, now there's trouble. Now they're going to have to stop partying. They're going to have to stop having dinners and to go to war. It's going to disrupt everything. Now, just to stay at status quo. So Psalm 2 was about attacks from the outside. Psalm 3 was about Absalom, the attacks from the inside. The treachery in his own family, his own cause. He reaped what he sowed, you know, and it was, again, it was a life-threatening event. Instead of somebody foreigner trying to kill him, it was now his son.
Absalom. And we talked about the difficulties of that and some of the dynamics of that. When we get to Psalm 4, and we're on page 20 of the syllabus, and Psalm 4 is the first one that we get that does not have a historical setting. So we don't know where David was when he wrote it, why he wrote it, you know, anything of this type. And I commented that that's probably for our advantage. So we won't think, you know, because like when, on the Absalom Psalm, I won't apply that to myself, you know, because I'm not worried about Derek getting on a plane, you know, flying out here from San Jose to try to kill me and take over my job as a computer guy. Like Absalom was trying to take over the kingship by killing his dad, you know. I would sit there and say, well, whatever's in that psalm doesn't apply to me. Right? I would use the historical background to distance myself and not have to deal with those issues. Whereas, of course, all of those issues deal with us because they're all family issues. We all got those issues somewhere at smaller scales and in different pockets and in different places, you know, where sometimes we're the kids, sometimes we're the adults. You know, I mean, it applies to us somewhere and in some ways and sometimes. But we'll sometimes use the historical saying, ah, this doesn't apply to me, I don't have to deal with this. Whereas all the psalms that don't have a subscription, you know, a title, a superscription, or a colophon at the bottom that explains it, in those cases, it's just a generic experience and we step in there all the time. It's easy to go into the Psalm 4 and feel that and say, this is just like it. Lord, I'm right here. We just did this last week, you know, and here it is happening on Tuesday afternoon, you know, or Saturday morning, or Thursday night, or whatever, you know. And so Psalm 4, we're going to read it, like I say, on 20. We're going to read it again through the Hebrew, going to the right to left. The first verse there is for the ones directing with strings instrument, a psalm of David. And if you remember, I mentioned in the English Bible, that's not a verse. So even though it says in our little page right there, 4:1, that's the Hebrew Bible number. So in the if you go to a Jewish Old Testament, in a Hebrew Bible, Tanakh, or Torah, they will have that verse numbered 1. But if you look in their English Bible, verse 1 will be where we call verse 2. So our verse 1 will be their verse 2. It's just the superscription will say at the top to the one directing stringed instruments, a psalm of David. Okay? And if you remember what we said psalm was just twanging. So that's all the word psalm. There's a Greek word for twang. And so stringed instruments and twanging, that's what the psalms, because they were generally sung with musical accompaniment. Okay? All right, so now we get into the content in verse 2. When to call me, when I call, answer me, O God of my righteousness. And remember, this was that word God, Elohim. All right, this was just the covenant word for God. Remember, we had the very first sheet we put up. And then I think I've taken off. Well, I think I've cleaned them out. Yeah, I started getting too far behind, you know, that I'm starting to fall over, so I took out some old pages. So when we have God, capital G, but lowercase d's, this is that word Elohim, remember? And it's basically the title of God. It's like governor or president God. Because every now and then you'll find rarely, but you'll find a human that's called an Elohim, a deity. Not a deity, but a ruler. Because that means ruler. We have all the capitals, Lord and God. That's Yahweh. That in the old King James was Jehovah. And that's his personal name. That's his covenant name. That's his insider name. That's the people that know him from the inside in a relationship. When he makes the covenant with Abraham, it says, Abraham, come here. We're going to get into a special relationship. I'm going to adopt you and I'm going to bless the world through your family. So I love everybody and I'm going to deal with everybody fairly and in grace and goodness. But we're going to have a special relationship because I'm going to need you to be part of the way I bless these people. I'm going to bless all the nations through you. And so between us, instead of you just calling me my official title, I'm going to let you call me by my name. My name is Yahweh. I am that I am. Okay? And then we have a capital L, lowercase rd, and this is the word Adonai, which just basically means Lord or Master. And you would use this, a servant would use this, a butler would use this of the master of the house. In England, you'd use Adonai, for example. A servant would use this. And so it was appropriate to use that relative to God as well. Then I mentioned later that there was one other word that was used all around them, the word Baal, which meant master or lord too, and sometimes husband, because the husbands were sometimes called masters in the same way. But Baal, because Baal was also a deity in the Old Testament, a particularly bad deity of the Canaanites. Okay, God didn't want to be called that kind of lord. He didn't want to confuse the issue and said, call me Baal, because I'm your lord. Because he said, no, because I don't want you to get involved in the sacred prostitution, drinking of blood, all the stuff that they did, the really bad child sacrifice. I don't want to be associated with this kind of lord. Let's use just Adonai. So every now and then, later in Israel's history where they get sort of weak and, you know, compromising, you'll have maybe a word that's got Baal in it referring to God, like somebody's name, right? But very rarely, and not without his approval. Okay? Not with his approval. So, but among humans, every now and then they'll call somebody Baal, but that was generally a bad word in that culture because of this deity and the influence that this deity had upon them. Okay? So, with that in mind, when we look at this verse, when I call on me, answer me, God of my righteousness. Now there he's appealing to his title. So this is like an appeal not to a friend or person in the club that you're in, but to the president. So he's actually appealing for like justice. He's appealing to like a civil authority. That kind of model is what's going on here. So he's appealing to God as the moral governor of the universe. So a lot of prayers that you'll see in the Old Testament, they will, instead of praying to Yahweh, they'll pray to Elohim, appealing to him in his role as the governor of the universe, basically as the ruler, the moral governor, and saying, aren't you supposed to be holding up these laws? Shouldn't you be dealing with these treacherous over here that are about to destroy our society? Shouldn't you be doing with this? Every now and then things will get real desperate and the attacks are very personalized. They'll pull out Yahweh, it said, hey, between us, you know, I'm an insider here, Lord, but look, you ain't treating me like I'm an insider. Now, come on, you know, I'm supposed to have a special relationship with you, remember? Come on now, let me remind you of this. And that's part of what God encourages, because he wants us to pray according to his character and according to his will. You know, we've got that famous saying that if you ask anything according to his will, he grants it. And the problem is never believing that. The issue is always knowing what his will is. You know, Lord, is it your will that I, you know, sleep all day tonight? You know, let me pray for you. You know, I mean, so that's always, generally that's the issue. And that's a matter of being sensitive to the heart of God. And going through the Psalms will immensely help in that area. When Jesus was walking around, the reason Jesus could sit there and be perfectly know when to do a miracle and when not to do one, when to do a rebuke or to do just a merciful kindness and not even, you know, bring up the issue, you know, with whoever it was he was so totally in tune with the Father's will. You know, he one time has told his disciples, he said, the reason I'm working is my Father's working right now. Everything that the Father does, he shows me. And that's all I do. All I do is what he shows me he's doing. So he had that sensitivity. He could walk into a situation, you know, so in tune with God. Of course, he's part of the Trinity, but he was so in tune with the heart of God as the Messiah, the human Messiah, that he could see exactly what God's heart was in the situation, whether it was that of prophetic rebuke, you know, woe unto you scribes and Pharisees, or go that way and sin no more, or, you know, if has no man condemned you, then I don't condemn you either. The woman caught in adultery. He was always in tune, so in tune, but that requires knowing the heart of God. And knowing the heart of God is paying attention to where his heart is revealed, and a lot of that's in the book of Psalms. Okay, So, when I call to you, answer me, God of my righteousness. And sometimes righteousness, or this is like, sometimes they put the my at the end, so it would be God of my righteous God, as you'll see how it's translated over on the left. And righteous, remember we've talked about righteousness, and righteousness was always doing the right thing. Remember I contrasted it with holiness, you know, that I told that my first understandings of righteousness was like legalism, always doing, obeying the law. That was always what righteousness was a lawfulness, a total obedience to the law. Until I ran across the proverb, remember, that said, a righteous man has compassion for his beast, for his animal. And there are no laws about being compassionate to animals, you know, in the Moses law, with the possible exception of don't tread out the ox that's grinding the grain. But other than that, there's nothing much about that. And it just said, so what righteousness was more than legalism, it was also compassion. It was also a tenderness that's in the law vaguely. It's not in expresses law, okay? When Jesus and Paul and Hillel, the famous rabbi, sum up the entire law, when somebody asks them to sum up the entire law, they say, love thy neighbor as thyself, love the Lord. You know, love is the fulfilling of the law, it says in Romans, the book of Romans. And so love spills over into gentleness and kindness on animals and friends and pity. And so it's broader than just this. So righteousness is doing what's always right for that specific moment. Now, it never breaks any laws. It's not situational ethics. It doesn't, you know, break any laws. Okay? It just doesn't apply them in cases of mercy. It postpones judgment. It's patient until reformation can occur. It's patient until they come to their senses, and then they'll ask you for an apology or something of that. You know, it's gentle and patient about that thing. And so God is the God of the righteous. God is the God who always does the right thing. He always knows. It's really neat that when I get really lost and, you know, drifting twice a week. Twice a week, easily. You know, I get there and I'll remind God that in Timothy, Paul is talking about God, and he calls him the only wise God. I just love that phrase. Of all the false gods I create just on a daily basis, oh, success, fame, pleasure, various types of desserts, you know, things that start to become false gods. You know, the only wise one is this one here. This is the only one that I can, you know, is totally trustworthy, always delivers, and knows when to do that and when not to. And so this is the God of righteousness, and the psalmist is appealing to him. When I call to you, answer me, O God of righteousness. From distress, give me relief to me. Okay, in other words, he's got a prayer, but it's not a prayer for somebody else in this particular case, not the first. It's a prayer related specifically for some kind of distress, and doesn't say what so far. He needs some relief from distress. He's not yet saying anything about enemies. He's not saying anything about forgiveness for his sins that might have caused his distress, because not all distress is caused by sin. See? I mean, some attacks are just by Psalm 2 types. The nations are in an uproar and they attack you and you're in distress. So it's not all distress is not your doing. When you walk into the line of fire, it's not your fault necessarily, you know, at all. Give me relief. Be merciful to me. And I point out that's that word Hannah, that we get the word Hannah or grace from. And we gave the example, remember, of the difference between grace and mercy last week, I think. Was it last week or the week before?
Last time.
Okay. And remember, that's worth going over again about the dungeon. The difference between and grace and mercy are not differentiated in the Old Testament, but they are in the New Testament, but not harshly. A lot of times we'll ask God for mercy, and sometimes we'll ask for grace, and sometimes we know the difference, but a lot of times we're asking the same thing. But the difference in terms of the New Testament theology is that, remember, mercy is not getting what you do deserve, and grace was getting what you don't deserve. And we gave the example, remember, of Glenn in the dungeon. that was deserving of the punishment that he was supposed to receive, execution or whatever, and that mercy would be when the president of the country sent a pardon to me, right? And told the warden, don't give him what he deserves. He really does deserve this. Don't give him, set him free. So mercy would be where I was pardoned and set outside the prison on the street as a free man. That was what mercy would be, not getting what I do deserve. And remember, grace is getting what I don't deserve, and that's where the limo of the president meets me there at the gate, picks me up, he adopts me as his kid, takes me, puts me up in the palace, gives me a job in the royal administration so that I can leverage people because of now the heart that's been changed by this grace. Because somebody has had such mercy and such beneficence toward me, it transformed my life and the way I looked at other criminals like me. Right? And so that's grace, getting something so totally that I do not deserve in beauty and grace. And then mercy was just not getting. And God didn't stop at just the forgiveness of sins. We go on to adoption as sons and co-heirs and co-inheritors with Jesus Christ for the universe at the end of history. Somehow or another, when it comes time doing inheritance time at the end of time, it's not that I get a little house or I get what I lost growing up, you know, as an adult and as a human. Somehow the universe, the new one, I'm not sure I want pieces of this one. There's a new heavens and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. Somehow or another, I get a piece of that.
Getting what you do not deserve is grace.
Getting what you do not deserve is grace. That's goodness. That's after mercy. You don't get grace without mercy. Yeah, you got to have mercy first. Mercy is where you don't get the bad stuff you do deserve. Grace is getting the good stuff you don't deserve. So you can put good and bad in there, and that maybe clear it up there. Getting the good that you don't deserve versus not getting the bad that you do deserve. And so here he's asking for mercy and probably a little bit of grace here too, but mostly mercy because he's in distress mode. He's not asking God to install him on the throne or make him rich and fat and happy again. He's saying, get me out of the trouble I'm in. That's mercy. Mercy is getting out of distress. Whether he deserves the distress or not, he may not know. Half the time we don't know. You know, I'll be torn up about something. Say, Lord, what's going on? The heavens feel like brass. I feel cut off. Something's out and I don't know what it is. I don't know whether you're teaching me that to not rely upon the way I feel for our relationship, you know, so that I work on the basis of sight instead of faith, or whether there is something in my life that I need to bring it. You know, there's some unfinished business, you know, some issue that, you know, some place where I've been really angry at somebody or apathetic towards somebody or been arrogant or prideful or something, you know, something inappropriate that I didn't bring before you and say, this is not good. I know you don't like this. I don't even like this. And I went ahead and played in the mud anyway. And, you know, and those are things that sometimes he wants to bring your attention, and he'll be quiet and, you know, withdraw, you know, withhold some kind of blessing or something like this. But inside, just so where you can sense that something's out of whack, something's out of kilter. And we experience this in various areas of our life at different times. You know, you can tell that a dryness or the stress is, the psychologists talk about the stress being out of proportion to the real problem, you know, where the anxiety level is much greater than what the little incident you're worried about, you know, is worth, so to speak. You know, that's the sign there's something else in there kind of stuff. And so he's just asking for our help from distress in this particular case. Be merciful to me. Hear my prayer. It is an actual request. He's actually praying. 3 was sons of man. Bnei Ish, and sons of man was not just a word for human. This was actually the elite. We'll see this when we get into the quotes tonight, but the sons of man here, you would normally use just sons of Adam, which is a different word if you're just talking about humans, just talking about mortal. But sons of men are more, they're like the leaders in the group. You know, they're the leaders in the community. So he's being picked on by heavies. He's getting somebody that can actually do damage to him, to his family, to his reputation, to the economic situation, to his support for his, you know, his agenda as a king, you know, those kinds of things. I mean, these are people that can do damage. If he's right in what he's doing, these are people that can stop him from being fruitful and blessing people's lives and being encouragement to others. And so they can be seen as an enemy. I mean, they have the power to be that because they're B'nai-ish, sons of men. Sons of men, until when or how long will my glory you turn into shame? Implied, how long will you love delusion? And will you seek lies or false gods? We pointed out in this particular case, David's glory was that when he was in distress, he depended upon the Lord. You know, he didn't take matters into his own hand. He would pray and he would wait sometimes. You know, he knew when to trust the Lord. And he would, regardless of how it was, he would go worship. He would go to temple. He would go, you know, read his Bible. He would do the stuff that he knew to do. He'd pray. He would not snap out at people and vent and rant and rage, you know, about whining this, that, and the other against God, stuff like that. And that was his glory. That was his reputation. That was his honor. And these people were turning it into shame. They were making it a reproach. He said, oh, that's that old goody two-shoes David. You know, he's so religious. Yeah, yeah, but look what it got him into this time. God's not going to help him. It doesn't pay off. God helps those who help themselves. The Benjamin Franklin quote. Not from the scripture, so they'll take some kind of stance like that, and so they would you know make him a laughing stock sort of where he was, you know, in that particular sense. How long will you love delusion, and how long will you love false gods or love a lie? They of course had a different perspective on how you lived life. You know, they were going to take charge. They were masters of their own destiny. You know, they had all these, you know, catchphrases that they would do that wouldn't include God. Maybe they would include God a little bit. They would maybe say, well, you know, sociological studies show that if you devote 12% of your time to religion, you'll be happier than those who don't. You know, I mean, this is where you give God a little peace because he's a, you know, he provides some benefits to you. It's not that he's really a God, you know, at all, and demands respect and worship and consider, and really has more life than 12% would tend to indicate, you know, this kind of deal. And so they would have a different perspective, and they would love that. It would make them feel good about this. They would love delusions. And we talked about this. This is a classic problem we all have, is self-delusion. You know, we'll talk ourselves into how we're doing. We'll talk ourselves into the things we want, and I'm particularly gifted at this. Juicy rationalizations. You know, something won't work, and I'll come up with a thousand reasons why it wasn't supposed to work. Instead, I'm supposed to try it again. You know, or something. I mean, we really have a good way of, you know, talking ourselves into various things when God is a God of truth. You know, truth sets us free. Okay, we can become enslaved to our own delusions, to our own way we look at things, and never grow, never get stuck in a rut, and never, you know, our life to be transformed beyond that. And so these were these people. They just loved this delusion. They loved the false gods. They loved the lies. Everything was happy. Worked great for them. And they would be stuck in that forever. Be like time capsule frozen. He said, I'm the only one that's in touch with transcendence here, with a real God. You guys have all these false gods that you can manipulate. And it's a theme in the Old Testament all the time, whereas, and it gets worse the more idolatrous that Israel gets. You know, God would never let them make a statue of him. Now, you couldn't make a statue of God. You know, first of all, he was invisible. You know, but he didn't want to make anything in his image, men, birds. And, of course, all the other deities, all the other nations did this. The Canaanites, you know, they'd have, you know, little lion statues. They'd have little serpents. They'd have all these little gods, you know, bull gods. Remember the golden calf story at Exodus, right? This was the calf is Baal. Baal was shown as a bull or a calf in Canaanite culture, so that's what that was about. And so God would never let them do this, because the problem with statues is you can move them around. You can do whatever you want. You have this massive sense of control over this deity that's like a 6-inch terracotta figure. You know, there's no real awesomeness. You aren't awed in its presence. You know, it gets dusty, falls off, it's broken its leg off the little statue. Well, we'll fix it someday. It's no big deal. I'd rather spend the money on something else. You know, that God figure's not that important, you know. And so, God won't allow himself to be domesticated by us, because that's a lie. As soon as we do that, we don't open ourselves up to his life, to his truth. We're not correctable. We can't grow any. We cease becoming learners. And so that's one of the problems with lies and delusions and statues and stuff like this of putting God in a box, putting a God in so you can move the box around. And that's a very definite problem, and this was one that they've always had. Okay, and God won't let us do that. As soon as we start, He has to work on us as soon as we start pigeonholing Him, because He's it's a person thing. You got to learn a person. Okay, so learn a lie. 4. Know that He hath set apart Yahweh the godly for Himself, and that's that word set apart. Which is like a sanctification kind of word. You know, God has said, okay, well, we got 24 plates here. I'm going to pick these 3 just for my purposes. I'm going to use these in a special way. I'm going to use those to feed other people or something like that. And that was when God set apart Abraham. And He set apart Abraham and said, in you all nations of the earth will be blessed. He set him apart, not for blessing per se, but for service. And that's an important distinction. Abraham is going to be the most blessed of individuals, but it's only because he's a servant first. God picked him to bless the nations. And to the extent God pulled him apart as a tool of righteousness, as a minister of goodness, as somebody to be a carrier of grace and freedom and truth, that in that process the blessing just flows on Abraham, on anybody. Okay? When you're in the middle of the will of God, giving and sharing and loving and forgiving and encouraging and smiling and joking with, you know, in that stuff. That's where the blessing comes. You don't do those things to get the blessing. If you do that, you're just putting God in the, let's move him over on the left side of the mantle. I know that if I tip him this way, I get 12% greater crop yield. So let's do God this way, this Tuesday. Yeah, that's not going to fly. He really doesn't like that. It doesn't tend to bless those mechanical views of his work. And so you can't do it that way. Jesus used a great phrase. He says, he that loves his life will lose it. And he that loses his life for my sake will gain it. It's that paradox that if you go after pleasure by trying to do good, you don't get either one of them. But if you forget to play, I'm just going to do the good, whether it's pleasurable or not, then he blesses that. So that's the way it has to work. Because guess what? Guess who's like that? He is. Right. That's why this works this way. He built the universe after his own image. And that's the way it works this way. You give to others, you lead there, you're more blessed to give than to receive. Wham. Then you cast your bread on the waters, it comes back to you. Shaken down, measured, overflowing, all this kinds of stuff. Okay? So David is telling this person that, look, God set me apart. And there's that word Yahweh. He set me apart. That's that covenant, remember? I'm set apart. I'm in that special relationship with God. And I'm supposed to be a blessing, not only to you, but to everywhere else. And God has set these apart, the set apart, the godly, for himself. And therefore, Yahweh, that same Yahweh, he will hear when I call to him. I'm praying. Okay? So he's going to hear. I mean, you're over there, you know, trying to tear me down and destroy my work and, you know, derail my efforts to bless my people and stuff like this. But just be aware that I can pray to this God and your little house of cards is going to come down. You know, you're going to stumble. So may I suggest that before I get to that step, calling upon Yahweh to intervene as Elohim, as the ruler, you might consider what I'm about to say to you in the next couple of verses. Because he's going to hear me when I pray, so before I get around to praying that, let me give you some advice. And the advice starts out at 5. Be angry and don't sin. Search your heart when you're on your bed and be quiet. Offer sacrifices of righteousness, that's that tzedek word, the right kind of sacrifices, which doesn't mean the legally right. Remember, right is not just legal conformity, right? Because a legally conformed sacrifice would just be a heifer of a certain age or a lamb of a certain age and size, and you could fulfill the complete legal requirements of sacrifice and hate God and resent having to give it and hate every person who touches the sacrifice and whine and complain about it all day long, and that would not be a righteous sacrifice. That would be a legally prescribed, see, you would have satisfied the requirements of the law, right? But that would not be a right sacrifice, because the right has to do with the heart. You got to do the outside most of the time. A lot of times, sometimes you don't have to do the outside. God even cuts slack. If the heart's right, He cuts a lot of slack on how close you come to fulfilling the law. We'll see one time in Hezekiah, the book of Hezekiah, one of the kings, the later kings of Israel, they decide for the first time in a couple hundred years to have the Passover. Most of the people had not been having the Passover. They're supposed to come to Jerusalem three times a year. They haven't been doing any of this. Most of the stuff they were told to do, they didn't do in the law. Okay, and Hezekiah decides we're going to have the Passover. And so the Passover is, in the law, it said you have to have it on such and such a day, such and such a month. It lasts a certain, you know, there's a legal formula for it. He gets in there, and he realizes that he doesn't have time to do all this, because he's going to bring the whole nation in there. And he realizes he can't make it work logistically, because they've just woken up, you know, to the joyous opportunity to obey the law. And he ain't got time, so he goes to the Lord and he says, can we change the date on this to next month? Would you forgive us for breaking the law like this? What do you think God felt? What? You mean you're not going to do it after 400 years if I say no to a month delay? Who are you kidding, man? You need to party here. You need to get together and celebrate freedom from Exodus, from slavery. That's what the Passover was. Right? It was just this joyous occasion. He said, you know, obviously. And as a matter of fact, the situation repeats two or three kings later. We have the same situation again with Josiah, the good King Josiah, where they're not clean. There's not enough priests, not enough ministers that are clean, ritually clean, to even do the Passover. In other words, the ministers are all in jail. They don't even get out, you know, until, you know, after the feast is over. And so, what are we going to do? And the guy says, okay, well, let the ones who can have it on the prescribed day, and those who can't, out of town visiting, out of country, or they're unclean, a month later, let them have it. And so he changes the law because the heart was right. Right? Because the heart was right. He would not have said, my heart's right, if they had said, my heart's right, but I don't want to, you know, give up any of my flock for this. You know, they were poor people, you know, Lord, my heart's right about this, God, trust me. He would not have approved of that, because that's sort of a lie. You know, that's, you know, there's a limit to where you can go, and it's a dishonesty. And so, David tells these people, said, you can be angry, but don't go so far as to do anything wrong about it. I mean, you can be upset with the way things are, but don't sin. And you can, think about this in your heart. You can be anxious in your heart all day long on your bed, but just keep quiet. Don't get out there and spread rumors. Don't try to destroy the program. Don't go out there and make my reproach a shame, you know, my glory a shame. If you're going to be upset, keep it at home. Deal with it at home. And if you offer sacrifices of righteousness, and if you trust in Yahweh, and trust in Yahweh instead of trusting in their own way, if they trust in God's way of doing things, and that's Yahweh again, if they'll look at God as the covenant God that He was to them, right, then they won't. Then David won't have to pray about God being Elohim to them and judging them. See? Everything will be clean. They'll sit there and they'll experience the blessings and know the peace that David knows. So he's got these overt enemies up there that are presumably the cause of his distress. And he counsels them, hey, clean up your act here. Just calm down. Go home. Think about it. Calm down. Clean up your relationship with God. You know, right sacrifices for sin. Trust. He didn't say you have to turn your life completely around at all. He wasn't saying, you know, give all this money to the temple. You know, he just said two things. He said a sacrifice, which was just admit you're wrong. Just be honest about, you know, where you are, and then start trusting the Lord again. Wasn't all these, you know, righteous, you know, just a personal relationship with the living God who loves truth and likes people to trust in Him like you wouldn't have any personal relationship. Right? So do this. Then he shifts in verse 7. Many are the ones asking, who can show us any good? Okay? And there's some other people. We'll talk about who these people are. It's not the same people, not the enemies. These are just doubters. These are ones, who in the world can show us any good? In other words, the distress might have been distress on the nation. It might have been like a famine. It might have been a pestilence. It might have been some tough economic times of the country. It could have been invasion. You know, it could have been any number of things. And some of these people are just doubting. They say, who can show us any good out of this? Tov. Who can show us any good? And they're not confident that any good can come out of this bad situation. In other words, is God really big enough? You know, God's not big enough to even take care of this problem. This problem is, God can find me a parking place every now and then. You know, but I don't think He can deal with this crisis. This is, you know, it's sort of big. You know, who can show us any good? And the David shifts, because David's caught in the middle of this. You know, he's got detractors, and now he's got doubters. So he's got people that are, you know, overt enemies, and now he's got these doubters. And it may be him. I mean, he may be part of that. He might be in there wondering himself, you know, I've been in this a little long here, Lord. What's going on here, you know? And then he appeals to something. He does the smart thing here. He remembers Scripture. And there's this Aaronic benediction we talked about. We're going to look at, we'll switch gears here again in a minute. One of the things, Aaron the high priest, God told Aaron the high priest, when it comes time to bless Israel, thus shall you bless, you know, the Lord shine upon thee, may His face shine upon thee, may the Lord bless thee and keep thee. It's a benediction that we use in all the churches. A lot of times it's a dismissal when you're leaving, you know, the Lord bless you and keep you, make His face shine upon you, grant you peace. And, you know, that's the Aaronic benediction, the benediction of Aaron. And he appeals sort of to this. He says, let shine upon us the light of your faces, Yahweh. And this is from Numbers 6. And that shine the face. And we talked and we went through a bunch of references in those last couple of pages, which I just realized I didn't give you. Then I'll have to remind me to give you the handout. I did have a handout. I lied. See there again. I can go do a sacrifice of righteousness right there. You got any cream pie or chicken cacciatore I could sacrifice. Yeah. Right, exactly. Right. Very good. Well, I'm supposed to do restitution at a 4X, so I'll give you 4 cents. Right, 4 cents, right. He says, let shine upon us the light of your faces. And remember, the light of the faces were two things. One was the normal expression of kings, you know, was the beaming face. So when you walked in, when you walked into the court where the king was, you know, the king is always distracted with other work, right? And you might be an irritant. It might be, what? And you were not likely to get favor, a favorable, you know, response to your request, unless he looked up, oh, good to see you again, right? You know, the beaming face. So one was just the normal way a monarch back in those days. It was generally, and later, like in the book of Esther, you know, if you approached the king, it was a capital offense. You were subject to execution, unless the king extended the scepter in your direction and said, okay, let him in. Because the king's a busy dude. Right? I mean, they're trying to run empires and stuff like this. They can't just deal with every biddling thing that comes up. And so they can't allow unauthorized acts. So if somebody walks in, distracts away natural attention to some little thing or whatever, you know, whining about this, that, and that, whatever, you know, it's destruction. Everybody suffers because of that. And so they, you know, the larger empires had this punishable by death. And so when you went in, if you had a big enough issue, you might risk it. Right? If nobody else down the chain of command was responsive and helped you, you might say, I got nothing to lose. I'm going to get killed here anyway. The enemies are overrunning me or something of this type, or, you know, we're starving or whatever. I'm going to risk it and run in there. In the case of Esther, you know, it was genocide, remember? They had pronounced that it was legal to kill all the Jews on a certain day. One of this, a very anti-Semitic ruler in the kingdom had appealed to the king, and said, "There's a there's a people that exists within your kingdom. They don't obey your law. They don't follow your gods. They're disruptive influence. You ought to kill them. And I'll donate almost a quarter, the figures are roughly 20% to 25% of the entire tribute within the empire is what this individual voted to fund a military, basically a military genocide, purge of the Jews within the Persian Empire. And the king said yes. Said, sure, that's fine. Actually, he said, keep your money, or most of it. And Esther, of course, was a Jew, but the king didn't know it. And a lot of other people knew it, but the king didn't know it. So Esther goes in to plead for her life, the life of her people and her family, right? So needless to say, she has nothing to lose, you know. I mean, and so she goes in, and he extends the scepter to her. His face beams to her, and he grants her an audience. And then through a couple of events, she gets to, you know, save the Jews in this process. Okay, and that's a massively funny story as to how that occurs. But that's I would love to go there, but I want to get through the Psalm tonight really fast. We got down to the last verse last time, remember? Here I am repeating it all. So, okay. So, but we may come back to that. We'll see. 826. The book of, see, here I am going already. The book of Esther is the only book of the Bible that never mentions the word God. His name is nowhere in there, but he is everywhere in there. You can see the providence of God through all the countless acts, and it's like a comic. The comedic timing of stuff in these events are just amazing. And I think I'll actually come back and tell the story since it's on my mind here a little later. Okay, let shine upon us the light of your faces, Yahweh. You put, verse 8, you put joy in my heart more than the time of their grain, the grain of them, and the new wine of them, they abound. Now, in English, that basically says, you put a greater joy in my heart than, quote-unquote, or elliptically, they have when they celebrate the harvest festival with an abundant crop. In other words, you would always have a harvest festival whether the crop was poor or not. And it would always be joy because you got to eat at least for a couple of weeks, you know, even if it was a really bad crop. But when it was an abundant crop, you were going to be able to sell it and buy that vase you've been wanting all year, you know, because you're going to have some extra crops. And that oil, especially up from that oil from Gilead, that bulb stuff, it was just great in the sun. You just put it on your, I guess it was just marvelous, just helped the skin. Just, you could face it because you had an abundant, I mean, it was just joy was through the ceiling. And that. But that was their joy. And David, because he puts their grain and their wine, and he puts it against my joy. He says, my heart knows more joy in my situation here because of my knowledge of you than what the rich and the successful and the elite and the prosperous people have at the high water mark of their life. At the best that the world has to give you when you get it. It is no question joy, because it's a joy from God, generally. Unless it's associated with arrogance and pride and, you know, superiority, some problems with that. But generally, because it's a blessing of God, and God loved those celebrations at Harvest Festival. When he would judge nations, that was the thing God every now and then would say, I miss when you would dance there. I love it when you celebrate, when your families are together and you have joy and stuff like this, you know. And so it's the best that the world has to give at the highest pinnacle of success and no enemies and no troubles and total escape from any troubles you do have because everything's just going great compared against just the personal joy that David has when God's face shines upon him in the very presence of the experience of God dwarfs all that. Not only will the abundant harvest of the crop, not only can it disappear the next morning with an invasion from a marauding tribe, and they could come any minute. You never knew when the Moabites would swing through, or the Amalekites would swing through, or Midianites would just come through and take everything you had the night before, just gone. And the uncertainty of riches, as they call about in the Old and New Testament, he said, I have this joy whether I'm in distress or in success. Paul said over in the New Testament, he said, I've learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. That I have learned to abound and I have learned to be without. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I'm happy no matter where I am. I've learned that joy of relating to God, be it many or be it few, you know, be it a lot or be it little. It was funny when I first heard that verse. The first time I heard this verse was at Florida Bible College. I was down in Florida, and a guy was talking, and probably 2/3 of the student body was from Pennsylvania, right? And they were not happy to be in Florida in the summer. It was hot and muggy, and we were on Miami Beach, and the teacher of that session was working through this passage, and he said, and I have learned in whatsoever state I am, therewith be content. He said, now you Pennsylvanians, remember this when you're here in Florida. Whatever state I am, therewith to be content. And there were some dour faces. People said, hey, you're taking that out of context. You know, this kind of thing, you know. And but this was the contrast. And it's interesting, the thing there that's important is the pronouns are important. He didn't say, you have made my joy greater than when my grain and my wine, new wine abound, my crops abound. But it's when theirs, because that's the best that they had, the high water mark, the best that the world has to give cannot compare to a personal relationship, a close, intimate relationship with the God of life who gives it. Everything else is just trying to build it. You're trying to put it together, okay? And he can actually flow it in, and we're back to the tree. We're back to the tree and the roots, right? Okay. More than the time they're grain and new wine, in peace together, together in peace I will lie down and I will sleep. For you, Yahweh, alone in safety, you make me dwell. In other words, I'm distressed. When I started this psalm, I was in trouble. I was crying out about this distress. People were raking my good reputation. You know, the grapevine was just horrible. The rumor mill was just killing me. People were looking at me funny, whispering as I walked down the street. You know, all this kinds of stuff. And at the end of the day, because I've remembered who I am and who God is and what about grace, and I remembered what it takes to be successful and how real life is over here and it's not over there and what they want me to aspire to, because of that, I can sleep tonight. I'll sleep tonight. I'll lay down and I will sleep, for you make me dwell in safety. And it's an interesting word there. I've always loved it. It's that you alone, Yahweh, make me lie down in safety. And I've always pondered that, because this is a king. He's got a staff, right? He's got a staff, an administrative staff. He's got political alliances that are as fickle as the day is long. Absalom, you know, will take them down somewhere and then wham, all of a sudden, you know, they're gone. They're just gone, you know. And then he'll get sick and then everybody will wait 3 days. And if he doesn't get well, they assume God's judged him. And people on the fence say, see, we knew he was bad all along. You know, I mean, you can't win some of this, you know. And David will every now and then you'll see it, he'll say, trust in the Lord, for the help of man is worthless. That's one of my favorite verses. He says, trust in the Lord, for the help of man is worthless. Don't trust in princes, their help is worthless too. And it's just it's a great English translation for the help of man is worthless. And so you can trust humans, his staff, if he's trusting Yahweh first. See, if I trust the Lord to be in charge of how my staff is doing, you know, or my friends or the people that are co-workers with me in some task, I trust the Lord for their behavior as well as how I treat them. That element in there too. But I trust God to manage that whole thing. And if somebody slips up, I trust God to make up the slack within that ecosystem, you know, within that little bubble of people, right? And so I can still have trust of humans, you know, in the context of trust of God. And there are times where you just trust when you know it's going to fail anyway, because that's just what love might do in that particular case. when we think of Jesus knowing ahead that Judas is going to betray him, but goes ahead anyway and selects him not only as a disciple, as an apostle, but the person in charge of the money. He trusts him with the books. And he's the keeper of the bag, as John said. He was one that all the donations, he kept the bag of money. And John was the only one that said, when one of the ladies came up to Jesus the week before he died and anointed his feet and his hair with this burial ointment, she knew enough about Scripture that he was about to die. You know, that it was his time had come at crucifixion. And Judas complains. He says, "What about this such wasting all this expensive stuff? That money, that stuff could have been sold, and the money given to the poor." And I think it's John. John says, "And Judas didn't say this because he cared anything about the poor. He's cared because he helped himself to the goods in the bag." That's what he said. Because he would just take stuff out, you know, figuring that he was worth it, you know, because he managed the money and he deserved, you know, some kind of, you know, administrative fee. I'm sure he just had a perfect good way of just, I would have been able to come up with one, I'm sure, just like he did, you know. It's why he deserved a cut, you know, out of the ministry funds, no doubt to support his efforts, you know, to help Jesus, you know, and the cult, stuff like this. But up until the betrayal, at the betrayal, Jesus never gives up on Judas. He sends him out on all the ministry missions. Judas is successful. Up until the very last thing, you know, up until the last supper, you know, he's telling him to tell Judas to watch. He'll say something about his betrayal, and he'll look over at Judas, and just hold, but won't rebuke him in front of the. He never reveals him in front of the apostles as to who it is, and anytime they ask him, he always uses a coded answer that they never understand. At the Last Supper, John, you know, they settled, the table was about the size of the height of the coffee tables. So the Last Supper was not like our tables. They didn't have those tables for several, you know, 1,000 years later, essentially. The table would have been roughly the size of, like, from the divan behind the sofa to, like, about here, that height, and about as wide as from your foot to my foot. Okay, and it would have been a low table. They would have been seated around on the floor facing this way. In other words, so when you sat at a table, because there's no place to put your feet, you know, they didn't have it hollowed out. So if this was the table, you would sit like this. You'd sit like this, and so the next person would be sitting there facing that direction around, like cards, like you would fold cards and make the little, you know, standing things like it. That's the way you would do it. And so, when Jesus is troubled at the Last Supper, he says his spirit was troubled because he knew it was sort of coming down to the last chance for Judas, and he knew what was ahead for him. And he said, "I desired to have this supper with you, and I tell you the truth." And he'd already told him before, "One of you will betray me." And for the first time, the disciples are starting to get it, because it says in the Scripture that when he says that, it says, "And they began to discuss among themselves who it might be." Now, a year and a half earlier, they would have said, "No, it's not going to happen. We love you. We serve you. We're not unfaithful people." But they had learned by being around the only righteous human that's ever lived, the only faithful one, they began to understand that they were capable of anything. That they could. The best and brightest among them could turn moments' notice and be the betrayer. So they began to discuss among themselves who it might be. And then Peter is always such a rash young man, just a precious soul. He mellows out so beautifully. It's just a testimony of grace. It's incredible. He's the one that wants to, you know, fight people and always make these claims. "I'll never betray you, Lord." You know, he's always making all these rash claims, and you know, he's the one that God chooses to humble with before the, you know, rooster crows three times. "You're going to deny me three times," you know. And he said, no, you know, and this kind of stuff. And he uses that to humble, to get him in a place where he understands that I am human, and you are the only God. Well, Peter is apparently sitting over there, and in Scripture. And John, the Apostle John, is sitting at this spot next to Jesus. And John is a smart man, very smart man. He's leaning on the breast of Jesus. Because in intimacy and closeness, it's a very logical thing. You would just lean back on one another and close friends back then, because it was nothing sexual with it or anything like that, you know. And he was leaning on the breast of Jesus. And it said that Peter motioned, it's what the scriptures, motioned to John to ask Jesus who it was. And you can see, and I try to think of what the little head just... And you could just see the dynamic there, because Peter was afraid to ask, you know, because he just opened his mouth one too many times. He says, "Lord, no, you're not going to die. Get behind me, Satan." He calls him Satan. It tells him he's not got his heart on the God. You know, so Peter's getting a little gun-shy by now, you know, and he's already done the three times thing. So, you know, he was wondering about this. And John, you know, leans back and Jesus says, "Who is it?" And instead of saying, "It is Judas," he says, "It is the one to whom I give the bread that I dip the cup." And at the Passover meal, especially back in that time, you would take the bread and you would dip it in the sop, the little lamb milk sop, and then you would give it to the most honored guest, which was Judas. Jesus dipped it in and gave it to Judas. Still working on Judas. Doesn't give up on him. Give him the thing of honor. And then he said to Judas, he pauses and he says, "What you do, do quickly." And Judas goes out. And the disciples say, "We didn't know that he was talking about Judas," because we assumed he gave Judas some kind of instruction to go do something, because he's, you know, he's the vice chairman. You know, he's the, right? He's the, and so they never knew it was Judas until Judas comes into the Garden of Gethsemane with the soldiers, you know, in the scene. He comes in and he walks up to Jesus and gives him that famous kiss. It's dark in the Garden of Gethsemane. He tells the soldiers of the high priest, he said, they don't want to capture the wrong guy and make a martyr out of somebody and the big guy get away and then the movement gain power. You know, they want to catch the real one in the dark. And Judas says, "The one whom I kiss is the one." So he knows it's Jesus, where they stay out, because they went to Gethsemane a lot. And he goes up to Jesus and says, "Hail, Rabbi." Hail, teacher. And then Jesus calls him friend. Still calls him friend. Said, "Betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss?" You know, and he says, He says one or two things to him there, but he calls him friend. He still calls him friend to that end. He never gives up. He just flat never gives up. And I don't know how in the world I got off on that. Alone. Yes. So God doesn't give up, and you can trust in God. And the main thing about this is that God may not get me out of this trust. When I trust God alone to get me out of some distress, either he will or he won't. It's never he tries and fails, or he never gets started and changes his mind because he doesn't like me anymore, or he doesn't start down the path and says, "You know, this is too uncomfortable. I'd rather be taking a nap," and abandons. Whereas that might occur with humans. All of those might and sometimes do. And so David will say, "My trust, because I trust alone in you, only in you, either you will or you won't." I mean, you may not deliver me. You may let the bad thing happen because you've got other providential plans and how you're going to use this or whatever. And I can understand that. And I trust you to make good choices, the only wise God. I may not understand it. I may disagree. It hurt like a son of a gun. But I'll trust you. But if you're going to deliver me, you don't need any help. And you may use people. Generally, he will. Normally, there are times where God could do something in our lives without, you know, any weird way of doing it. But he will deliberately, most of the time, use people to teach us about community. I mean, if there's one thing he wants us to do is to know other people and trust other people and grow in friendship and love and being there for one another and friendship and closeness. He will go out of His way to create events that will create community. So He'll create an artificial crisis in our life. We'll ask for help, and He'll send somebody to help us. Kind word, somebody to listen to us, you know, somebody to offer a bit of advice, somebody to tell us about a contact, you know, something of that type, just so we'll say thank you to somebody else and appreciate that. He'll just go either way, because it's only in becoming thankful people that, one, we can relate to God appropriately, and that spills over in the lives of everybody else. It's just amazing when somebody tells you thank you, that changes everything. If it's a sincere thank you, it just changes the day. It changes the way you look at them, especially if you've not liked them up until that moment. All of a sudden, they soften up and thank you and express some appreciation and respect. It can change 10 years of hard feelings in 30 seconds. You can sit there and say, "This is something. This is, I never saw this side of this person. You know, I need to rethink this." You know, and so. So God will often, even though it's an alone, God may have bailed David out here with some people or something of this type. Okay, now let's move over to the actual textual stuff. In verse 21, and I'm going to try to read through actually, I'm going to have to skip through. I read through all this in painstaking detail already. Let me do this on page 22. Let's look at that top paragraph. Let's read this one. It is not clear who the many were. Remember when I talked about many are asking who can show us any good? Right? It is not clear who the many were. Were they skeptics? Or were they his supporters who honestly questioned what was happening? Whoever they were, David prayed for them also and called on God to make his covenant blessings evident. He did this by an allusion to the priestly benediction. They asked, "Who can show us any good?" David responded by pointing away from himself and to the Lord as the author of blessing. He didn't say, "Well, I know nobody's showing you good, but I'm your king, and I'll figure a way out for us." No, he said, no. Actually, let's go back to the roots, the foundation. Let's remember this is, we started with God, and God gets us through this. Let's go back to the blessing of God. Okay? Then the next paragraph, he committed his way to the Lord as he went to sleep. The enemies may have vexed themselves on their beds, but he experienced peace. The peace that comes as a blessing from God. His confidence in Yahweh alone is the reason for his peaceful sleep. The expression, "make me dwell in safety," connotes not only the absence of enemies and hostilities, but also the presence of peace. Now there's a list of scriptures there, Deuteronomy 33, and Jeremiah 23:6 is one of the more famous messianic prophecies. Behold, will come forth the branch. The branch is one of the words for the Messiah, for Jesus, in the New Testament. And they refer specifically that He's the one that will give Israel peace and will make His people, will give His people peace and will make Israel lie down in safety. In other words, it is the face of the branch, the Messiah, that will be the agent that God uses to bless, to provide the Aaronic blessing to His people. The face of Jesus will be the glowing face for Israel in the future, and was back then as well. Okay, let's look at the last paragraph there. I just want to just mention this again, make sure we get this one. The joy and contentment David experienced in trusting the Lord was greater than the mirth of the harvest festivities. Even in distress and away from the visible evidence of God's goodness. In other words, there was nothing out there. He couldn't look out the window and see blessing. All he saw was protesters out there. All he saw were where friends used to be hanging out. There was nobody there. They were people that looked downcast or worried. Even in distress and away from the visible evidence of God's goodness, he enjoyed peace and safety in his God. True joy and peace depend not on circumstances, but on God's protection and provisions. Okay? It has to do with where God is in your life. I remember in college going to a religious a Christian thing after I'd given my life to the Lord. I went to one of those, I think it was a campus crusade kind of thing. I didn't do much crusade, so I don't know. But I think it was one of those, or one of their like meetings or something like this. And they had a speaker up there, and he was talking about the life that's above the normal life, this kind of life here that depends upon God. And he was talking about a conversation, and this is a little Pollyanna, sunshine-ish kind of slogan, so you got to watch this because it's not always supposed to be this way. But he asked somebody, well, how are you doing? They said, I'm doing pretty good under the circumstances. And he said, what are you doing under there? You're supposed to be above the circumstances. You know, that's a little, like I say, sunshine. It's because there's half of the Psalms are blues. You know, I mean, you could put these to a good blues lick. You know, go, God, how long? You know, everybody hates me. You know, what's my job? You know, my kids are, you know. I mean, there'd be this kind of despair, and there are times to recognize that from the Lord. But the thing is that no matter what the circumstances, the relationship with God can be a source of inner peace and stability. And I remember telling somebody that, yeah, I'm always in crisis. I've got crises going on all the time, things that are eating at me, anxieties, etc. But it's the difference, but they're three levels up. I've got this bedrock of peace that's like 100 feet under the surface of the ocean where it moves slow and it's thick and it's solid, as opposed to whipped stuff up at the top that's whipped away by winds and really ripped little currents and everything's turbulence up there. And I got plenty of that up there. But all I can do is stop for a second and realize that the peace that I've got because of my relationship with God is this anchor, just this deep substrate that when I talk to somebody that doesn't have that substrate and only has the same like crisis or chaos up at their level, that's all they have. And so their life is, that's all the way down. You know, their whole life is a shambles and pieces. Well, mine is just, it's confined to this little bitty window. It's just this little area, and sure it hurts, and sure it's difficult, but it's just dwarfed by this peace that I've cultivated, you know, that the Lord has grown in my heart over 30 decades, you know, 3 years, 30 decades of this, and 35 years of this. And so there's this that thing that no matter how bad it gets, there's still that bedrock, there's that substrate, there's that foundation, there's that, no matter what the temperature out here is where my leaves are. The roots in Psalm 1 are still drawing the water because I was planted there. Remember the irrigation channel was dug and the tree was specifically planted there. Okay. Now, I want to get to the little in the middle of that page where I got all the Hebrew, because this is one of the cool things about Psalms. Remember, they're musical. Remember, they're sound. They're things that you would say and that you would remember them because of the way it sounded. You know, they would be songs, like in English, the tune to Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, right, is the same as A, B, C, D. Now I've said that, A, B, C. A, B, C, D, E, F, C, how I wonder what you are. Up above the world so high, telling you no fear. However that goes, I never learned that part of it. That's why I'm a bad speller. I got lost there. All right, same thing with like Row, Row, Row Your Boat and London Bridge is Falling Down. Those are the same tune. And so there are these things in our culture where you never recognize that. I didn't know that until I was 50. I read that in a book on memory techniques in ancient cultures. That's the way they do it. You know, you carry it, right? And so in these words, look at the words in that little Hebrew chart. These are words where the sounds are the same and they're repeated at least twice in this little bitty song. This is page 23. It's this little section right in here. So there's the word call, and it occurs in verse 2 and verse 4, and it's the same, if you read it from right to left, it's the same letter. See the same little symbols? And same thing with like bed and lie down, those are the same sounds. I'll say the sounds. Call there is bakara, bakara. Bed is mishkaka, and then lie down is ishkaka. Righteousness is sedeki. And in verse 6, it's Sedek. Trust is Bataku. And safety is Batak. anyways, as you would have said this tiny little thing, the sounds would have jumped out at you, especially if you did it singing it around. They would sing things multiple times. You know, I mean, they would do this. And so these little rhythms and the rhymes would stick with you in the words. And there's so many of them, if you see that, in that little, that small little psalm. Hear, heart, many, abound. You know, just it's dense with a musical, a memorable kind of tone, right? And now let's go to that next paragraph. The Lord who answers prayer, verses 2 through 4. The psalmist turns to prayer with trouble brooding in his mind. He has been accused quite unjustly. Remember, they took his glory and turned it into reproach. He has been accused quite unjustly of some crime or sin, and though he knows that he is innocent, the reproach hangs heavily upon him. All he can do is turn to God. He has no particular request other than that God hear him and grant him some peace of mind. The source of his anxiety is described as the sons of man, who are persons of significance or influence, as distinct from the common people. These sons of man, in their persistent pursuit of vanity and lies, have made the psalmist's reputation as nothing, a word of reproach. And their words come to mind as he engages in prayer. So he prays for God to answer, for the accusers will not answer his protestations of innocence. I mean, you see, getting in an argument with them. You know, I didn't do it. Oh, yeah, you did. Everybody knows you did. You can't win that. Hello. You know, all you do is make it worse. You know, because they say, oh, yeah, he defended his innocence so much, he was obviously guilty. You know, I mean, you can't win that at all, human nature. But merely persist in their falsehood, feeling hemmed in and constrained by his human enemies, he asks the God of his righteousness, the one who knows he is innocent, to give him room or to release him from the straits and pressures to which he has been subjected. He requests God's grace, which would bring release from the human acquisitions. Now I want to skip down to the last paragraph there. It is not a psalm of penitence arising out of the recognition of sins committed. There are other psalms for that purpose. Remember, he doesn't confess any sin. He didn't do anything wrong here necessarily. You know, again, he's just in the line of fire. Maybe he's getting fired on because he's good. He's trusting the Lord in spite of maybe some pestilence or some tragedy of the nation or some something of this type. It is rather a psalm which reflects the anguish of the innocent and the oppressed or the righteous sufferer. And thus is it a particularly important kind of psalm, for it addresses a fundamental human experience, the experience of injustice, suffering, and oppression. There's no suggestion in this psalm that the accusers go away or cease their accusations. What changes as a consequence of prayer is not the external circumstance, but the inner spirit of the worshiper. See, it's us. See, there are two enemies in this situation when we started. There's them and us. And us is what gets fixed in here, our heart. We end up trusting the Lord and saying, well, I do know the truth. I know I didn't do this. I'm not just, You know, why should I let this affect the way I see myself? You know, I really ought to be who I know I am before you, Lord. The accusations are like barbs in the mind, needling and prodding, causing anxiety. Prayer leads to that calmness of mind in which the accusations can be accepted and carried, for a greater peace of mind has come from God. That's that bedrock. Anyways, I'm still going to worry. It doesn't matter. I can sit there and say, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Those are the only things that hurt. Of course, you get healed from sticks and stones, but the words will stay with you forever. We all have those moments. And so the thing is, they're up here. You just grow something deeper that puts them in a context. Something, a psalm, a balm of calming. Psalm 4 is thus a prayer which can be used by every believer, for there are none who do not experience to some degree or another the turmoil of mind expressed in this poignant psalm. Okay? So that's that psalm. Like I say, that was an anonymous one. It wasn't one. It's just one where things... Now, this is not one where you just have some, like, things have gone bad. This is where actually people are complaining. I mean, this does have a human element. This is in the community in which we live. God's trying to grow it. So we do have very definitely, we would have a lot of this. We would have frequent occasion to pray this kind of prayer. Lord, I don't know how I got here. What did I do to these people? You know, there's some, you know, normally when you do something, when you have a beef, know, the general scripture thing is that you try to go in quietness and clear it up. You know, try to say, help me understand something. I've done something wrong here. You know, our relationship is strained. We've had a good relationship in the past. I've done something. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it's Dan Histamine. You know, but I sense something's wrong. You know, have I done something? Just help me. You know, you're too good of a friend or too good of a citizen or community member or something, you know, for this to be a problem. Just, am I, you know. And 25% of the time, that, of course, that totally backfires on you. It gets really bad. Gets negative and stuff like that. And then you're right here in the middle of the sob. A lot of times, just that honesty is just like that person that thanked you, you know, 10 years of thing, and, you know, 30 seconds they say, you know, I've never told you, but I really respected the stance you took on such and such, the thing you said such and such ago. I had a situation that, actually, a loose association here. When I first moved back, I went to one of the blues festivals, and there was a guy that was in my graduating class of high school. And he was probably the roughest guy in the class. He had been held back a year, maybe two, failed. And, you know, he was back then it was the blue denim, blue jean crowd. You know, they were the wild crowd. And of course, they were the popular wild crowd and things of this type, you know, and they would have nothing to do with me, of course, you know, not would I be too afraid to do whatever they were trying. That's a separate issue, you know. But in the senior year, in the last semester, he approached me in homeroom and said, I'm not going to make it out of high school if I don't pass this math class. I'll offer to pay you to teach me math. And so I didn't take his money. And so we would meet together, you know, to help him through his class. And he graduated in the class, right? And I got to know him, you know, in that time frame and that talk. And I paid him a compliment that 35 years later, 40 years later, something, 35 years later, he comes over to me at the blue, we recognized each other at the blues thing, and he comes over and I ask him how he's doing, and I recognize him, and he said, you know, I really want to thank you for teaching me the math, and then the thing you said about that I was the only person that you had ever met that thought before he spoke, because he was. I can still count on three fingers people that really stop and think before they say anything. You know, when you ask him something. And he said, that has stuck with me. And all these years, it has meant a world of difference to the way I live my life. Just that one little remark. You know, and I'd completely forgotten that remark. And I told him that I was, you know, that I'm still insanely jealous of that ability. You know, I still can't do that at all. You know, I'm just, you know, put it in gear, and then engage the brain a few minutes later, put the mouth in gear, and put the brain, you know. And that thing had stuck all these years to this individual. And, you know, and this is that 32nd in 10 years, you know, thing at a larger scale. You know, it was just an immense kind of thing, because it just, you never know. When the tiniest word of kindness, or support, or comfort, or challenge in some cases, oh, come on, you can do it. You know, you never know where that's just going to make a huge difference of leverage, because that's God blesses those little sowing of the seeds. And so I used to use the phrase, what you want to do is not one giant rock of Gibraltar of goodness, but you want to create an avalanche of righteousness, one pebble at a time, one rock at a time, to where it is so big, where people can, you know, they can brush away a couple of stones, you know, but you can't outrun an avalanche. And that's what you try to do. Because you can, see, we may not be good enough to do the big Gibraltar quality stuff. But, you know, I could take 5 minutes a day and do something good. Little bitty pedal. And add it to that avalanche. Right? And the psalmist is sitting there basically looking at the model of that God will be with me, and I'll go out there and I'll try to reconcile. I'll try to do something. I'll tell them, hey, just, you know, you guys, I understand you're upset. Just do it inside and, you know, work through it, and then come out, you know, trust the Lord and everything will be okay. And he prays for the doubters, and it gets beyond just his distress. Show us the face. You know, he wants them to be blessed. right? So it spills over into the lives of others. That's the way it's supposed to be in our relationship with God, where He heals me and touches me. It's supposed to spill over into the lives of others. And that's the way it's supposed to. And so Psalm 4 fits in that kind of category for us. And we'll see a different one in Psalm 5 will be very, very similar to it. It's another one of those sort of anonymous ones. But it has, a different flavor. It's got a little stronger persecution. People are after them a little harder. But Psalm 4 is one of those general ones where, you know, and when you go into a Psalm 4 situation where there's distress, you're not sure whether you need to be in one of, in that psalm or in a psalm of forgiveness requesting. You're not sure how you got there, whether it's, you know, whether this is, you know, sort of a little chastening, a little discipline, you know, a little wake-up call. And so, but we generally tend to start to think, depending on how morbid you are. I'm morbid. I always start over in the guilty ones. You know, I always assume that there's something like that because I probably deserve that. You know, but a lot of people will start out in just in the distress, and that's probably the better one. That's probably the more righteous. You don't want to assume that you're guilty because that may be just as untruthful as assuming that you're not guilty when you are. It's just as dishonest to sit there and say, I'm guilty. I'm sure I'm guilty of something, Lord. And you try to find something so you can get forgiveness when you're not, when it's not good, when it's just some other element in your life. And that's an honesty thing. Where there's no reason for me to feel guilty about something I didn't do. You know, I mean, I'm not, there are some other elements we'll talk about as we get into the 50s, the Psalm 50s of this. But I guess we better stop there. It's 9:06. But should we do 10 minutes on Esther? Do you want to just do this? I'll do a real quick flyover on Esther. Okay. Okay, so the Jews get carried into Babylon, right? You know, the exile, right? They're over there. Persia conquers Babylon, and then and Persia. Persia's got a king. Persia's being pressured by the Greeks now. The Greeks, Alexander, and all those guys are pressing on Persia, but the Jews are in there, and the Jews are living in there. Well, there's this particularly wonderfully funny uppity woman scene. In the opening of Esther, the king gets up there and he's actually, it's a fundraiser. He's got this fundraiser for 6 months. He brings all the nobles in. He's trying to raise money for his military campaigns against Greece. And they're all drunk and, you know, they're partying and stuff like that. And he's got this beautiful wife, Vashti. And so he wants to parade her around in front of his guests. Well, that is so bad in culture generally, because back in the ancient cultures, you didn't parade your wife around anybody. You know, I mean, your wife was a private thing. You didn't make public appearances like, you know, the presidents would. You didn't take your wife on all these diplomatic meetings. She wasn't a public figure. It was a private family thing. And so they had, you know, they did the veils and all that kind of stuff. So you didn't parade them around, period, much less in front of a gigantic fundraising crowd, right? So she says, no, I'm not going. Because she's having her own party for the wives of the diplomats in her own castle. So she's not going to go. And so after they all sober up and all these things goes away, the king doesn't know what to do with his wife, you know, because this has never happened before. And so he asked the counselors, his chief of staff and his cabinet, what should we do? Because she's disobeyed an order of the king. So it's not just like, you know, a domestic dispute, but it was an actual order given in front of everybody. And they say, well, I tell you, we're going to have all hell's going to break loose. Because when every other woman in the country knows that the queen stood up to you and got away with it, then there's no end to the rebellion that's going to happen, and no man will be safe in his own. You know, and look at this from a great male perspective. Right. So why don't we just dethrone Vashti? Of course, she gets to keep all her wealth and all. You know, dethrone her and find another king who is more worthy of being the queen. So they have a beauty contest. He says, well, let's go for it. You know, they have a beauty contest, and so they take all the beautiful women of the kingdom, of which one is this Jew, Esther. Her name was Hadarach, her Jewish name, but her Persian name was Esther, which means star. Like Esther means star. Right? Aster, astral, astronomy, that's star. Okay. Now, she's being raised by her uncle, Mordecai, who is a clever Jewish man. He's really smart. And he works. He's like a judge. He's like in the administration. He works outside the king's cabinet thing. And the rising up and coming political star is this guy named Haman. And Haman is we think he's an Amalekite, which were those people that hated Israel, were raped through, and sell them into slavery, picked off the weak and infirm. that when they came out of Exodus, you know, out of and they're touring, the wheat that couldn't keep up, they came in and they'd capture them, steal them, kill them, sell them into slavery. They were that brutal of a cruel of a people, right? Now this is a descendant, and he generally doesn't like the Jews at all, but he because back then, you know, when you were a person of importance, you would bow in their presence. Like over in Japan, when you meet somebody, you both have to bow, but the person who is of lower stature has to bow lower. So when I go over and I met with the CEO of one of our companies, and I'm just a little VP type, when we meet, we both bow to one another, but I have to bow lower than he does, you know, as a sign of submission. And the worse I am, the lower I have to bow, right? Okay, this kind of thing, right? Well, they had that kind of thing, and so, and when Haman, this guy, would come through, everybody would bow except Mordecai. Mordecai wouldn't bow at all, and when they'd ask him, Mordecai, why would you? He says, it's against my religion. It wasn't, but he was just making that up, it turns out. So, and this really, Haman didn't like this. Well, Esther, of course, became queen. He liked her best. She became the queen and has her own palace and everything, but nobody knows she's Jewish because Mordecai told her, don't tell anybody you're Jewish, okay? And that's fine. And so she's up there and has power. Everybody loves her. All this kinds of stuff. Well, this Haman guy really is irritated with Mordecai. And so he goes into the king and he gets in that story I tell you at the first about there's a people among us that don't do your laws. They've got their own diet. They've got their own God, blah, blah, blah. They're disruptive. We ought to kill them off and I'll donate all this money. He says, go for it. So Haman goes out and he says, this is great. So he gets a royal decree that the Jews can all be killed and plundered for their wealth, and they're wealthy at this time, you know, this. And then Mordecai, he sees Mordecai, and Mordecai still doesn't bow, and still upset, and then when he finds out he's a Jew, he's even more incensed, and so he asks his family, Haman goes home, and he's telling them, about how the king shows him all his favoritism and invites him to all these parties. You know, he's a favorite and all this kinds of stuff. And he's always asking him to do things for him and things of this type. But he's really irritated by this Mordecai guy. Really hates him. And then all of Haman's buddies said, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you build a gallows 50 meters high? I mean, it's as tall as the almost as a city wall. I mean, it's gigantic. You know, hang, and they'll kill him. It's not a hanging. They didn't do hanging, you know, death by choking in those days. They killed you first, and then they just hung you up there as a spectacle, you know, show what happens to those people that did this. That was what hanging was like back then. So, he builds this thing, and the timing is what's funny about this on the providence thing, because Mordecai then goes and tells Esther, hey, look, we're all going to die. You need to go into the king and beg for us. To see if the king can overthrow this law or something. And Esther says, hey, look, if I go in there and he doesn't do the scepter, I'm going to die. And Mordecai says, hey, look, don't think you're going to be the only Jew that escapes this. You know, you're dead already. You better just go on in there, right? And so she goes in, the day before she goes in, the day before Haman has built this gallows for Mordecai, he's going to go in the next day and ask the king if he can hang him, right? Well, that night, the king can't sleep. The king can't sleep. And the king says, bring me the archives. And they find that he's reading in the archives, and he finds this story from years earlier, maybe 10 years earlier, of where there was a plot to assassinate him among his people. And Mordecai, who was at the gate, overheard the plot and told the king's people, and the king, you know, saved his neck. Oh, because of Mordecai, and Mordecai's name was in there, and the king said to his couriers, they said, well, what was done as a reward to Mordecai for this noble act? And they said, nothing was done for him. He said, I can't believe it. So he gets up that morning, goes out into the court trying to figure out how he's going to bless Mordecai. Here comes Haman to ask him for Mordecai's life, and Haman, and the king says, come here, Haman. Who's in the court? Haman. Bring Haman in. He says, Haman, I got a question for you. What should the king do to the man that the king wants to honor above all people? I mean, how would you reward somebody like that? And it says that Haman says, he's thinking about me. He's thinking about me. I'll just make up the best thing I can think of. Well, the man that the king should honor should be mounted on a royal horse that the king has ridden on, a throne be put on him, 50 footmen to run in front and said, here comes the famous person, and the king's most trusted advisor and head regent should lead the horse in front of this person. Right. And the king says, that's great. I want you to immediately go do this for Mordecai, and you be the one that leads the horse. Right. Oh, and then so he goes out and does this and leads them through the city. It says, thus shall be done to the man that the king wants to bless. Right. And so, needless to say, Mordecai goes home Haman goes home dejected this time. And then he tells these people what's going on. And his little buddies, and they say, well, you might as well make your grave because nothing's going to stand before the Jews. Your downfall has already started. And he's sitting there. But before that, by the way, when I told you that Haman had gone home and bragged about all how the king had included him, all these things. Well, one of the things, when Esther went in and looked for his face, you know, the shining face, right? She had asked if he could come to a private dinner at her castle, in her palace, and have Haman join them. See, she was going to explain the situation in front of Haman to him, right? And so they go, and he's proud that he's the only other person that's been invited to Queen Esther's, you know, party, right? Because he doesn't know she's a Jew. And so that was what he was bragging about, too. And not only this, but the king and the queen have invited just me to this party. So he's sitting there now dejected, realizing, having done this to Mordecai, realizing that all his friends are deserting him, you know, it's a psalm, you know, psalm experience, you know. And just then the guards come to escort him forcefully to the party with Esther and the king, right? So he's now just whipped up. So he goes to the dinner, and so it's him and Esther, and they're sitting around one of those little dining couch things. And it's they have actually a little couch to sit on, tables to recline on, you know, sort of like a, you know, like a love seat, but you would lay this way, you know, to a slightly more raised table. And so she's there, Haman would be there, and then the king would be there. And they go through this two nights of parties, and then finally the king says, you know, whatever you request to the half of my kingdom, I'll grant you. She says, all I want is my life and the life of my people. She said, if it were just we were going to be sold in slavery, I wouldn't have even bothered. It wouldn't be worth bothering you. But they're going to kill us. And he said, who's going to kill you? She said, I'm Jewish. And she points to Haman and said, this vile Haman has done this law that, you know, that this law you said that could go kill a people. You didn't know who it was, but it's me and my people. And they're going to kill him. I beg for my life. And the king is really upset with Haman at this point, just really hates him. And he goes out into the courtyard to calm down in the little thing. Well, at this particular point, Haman then comes over to Esther to beg for his life. He trips and falls on her just as the king is walking back in. And he says, will he even molest her while I'm in the house? You know? And he says, cover his head with a bag. And he covers him with a bag, which was pre-execution. And they haul him off. And then they bring Mordecai in, and Mordecai explains that, yeah, he's built this gallows to hang me. You know, Mordecai is now like the third ruler in the kingdom because he's been put in this place of a beauty and authority, right? Because he saved the king. And he's wise. He's a good ruler. You know, he's a good ruler. And so, and the king just cannot believe this. You know? He said, why don't you do this? Let's take the thing that they were going to that he was going to hang you on, and let's hang him on that. So they kill Haman and give Haman up, and then confiscate all of Haman's massive wealth. Remember, he was going to, and they give that to Mordecai to manage, and he gives it. Excuse me, he gives it to Esther. Esther puts Mordecai as the guardian over that. And so the sequence of events is, you know, of Haman coming in at the time and saying, what should the king do? I mean, it's just this amazingly providential story. And God is not mentioned anywhere in this. But you can sit here and look at how this, you know, the events of history. And it gives you encouragement that, you know, wherever I am, God may be moving in things that may happen in 10 years. So that's the story, the funny story about the timing. Just and my favorite is, like, say, him tripping. you know, and falling on her to plead for his life just as the king is walking in. It, you know, he can't believe it. You know, you put the worst possible spin on this. You wouldn't, well, I'm in the house. All right, let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, we do thank you that you are a big God. You are a good-hearted God. You look after your people and those that know you as Yahweh, and we want to know you in that intimate way, in that covenant way, and realize that we're special to you, and we want to walk with you. We want to live before you, and we want to apply Psalm 4. We want to turn to you when things are difficult. We want to hope the best for our enemies. We want to pray for them. People that are not sure, we want to pray that you would blessing upon them as well, Lord. We ask for help for us, but we ask for help through us to others, and that and times that are appropriate that we would be open and receptive to receiving help from others, because that's a separate challenge for us, Lord, in our pride and things of this type, that we would see your love for community and that we would accept help and that we would give thanks to others as well and change lives like this. We thank you for this group here, the hearts here. Bless them this week. And when we get back together again, and your will be done. We thank you so much for your love and your beauty in our hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.